Today's date is July 18th, 1997. The speaker is Jim DeLange. The subject is community. The title is Maintaining Connection to the Larger Church When You Were Kicked Out.
So the church where I have been pastor for the past 16 years. Prior to that, I was had an administrative office for 5 years with the one of the predecessor bodies of the ELCA. And prior to that, I served a church in Huntington Beach, California, for 14 years, a suburban church. And I'm up here on this week, my wife and I, and next week, teaching staff. And why don't we just, since we're so few, why don't we just introduce ourselves and say where you're from.
I'm Jim Lindis, and I'm an ELCA pastor from Whitby Island, Washington.
Okay. My brother-in-law was from Whitby. Langley?
Barbara Lindis, I'm from DeKalb, Illinois.
Great.
Robin Hartley from Berkeley, California.
I'm Steve Broy from St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm Jack Clay from St. Francis Church in San Francisco.
I'm Don Clausane, retired LCMS pastor from Arcata, California.
Oh, met some of your neighbors here. Well, actually, your son, your daughter-in-law's parents.
Yeah. I'm Ralph Lustico from Tacoma, Washington, member of St. Mark's.
Okay. All right. I don't know how much you're familiar with, so I'm just going to assume that you know a whole lot about our story and kind of start from the beginning in that way. On December 31st, 1995, St. Francis and First United Lutheran Churches of San Francisco were expelled for membership. I'm sorry, I forgot this. You can roll the tape. Sorry. On December 31st, 1995, St. Francis and First United Lutheran Church were expelled from membership in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. This was done after a 5-year suspension from membership. And the reason that we were first suspended and then expelled was because we had called pastors to our staff who were openly gay or lesbian and refused to agree with the ELCA guidelines, which at that time in 1990 said that practicing homosexuals are prohibited from serving in the ministry of this church. What I'd like to do is to kind of recount the events that led up to this, which I don't know that everyone is familiar with or not clear. And I think we need to understand not only the issues around homosexuality, but we also need to understand the politics of the church. And I talk about the politics of the church in the best sense of the word. And that is that understanding how it is that we as church people organize ourselves to do the work of the kingdom. How is it that we put organizations together and how is it that we develop in order to do this? We just need to start doing a little bit with dates. In 1977, the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches called for a Lutheran Union. This is the church body that was made up of about 1,000 pastors who left the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to form a new church because of the direction that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod was taking, which was very, very much to the right and away from the movement toward Lutheran Union and unity, which had been going on since the Second World War. This call for Lutheran Union resulted in the then American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America coming together with the AELC and making a number of decisions that in 1982 led to the decision to disband the existing church bodies and form a new church. And that was decided basically by the national conventions of the respective bodies. I think I've got the date on that right, I'm not positive. After this, what happened was that there was a commission of 70 appointed from each of the church bodies. The AELC had 8 members. The ALC and the LCAH had 31 members on this body. They were charged with organizing this new church, finding a name for it, finding a church headquarters, and deciding the way it was going to be organized. And what they did is that they decided that the name of the new church was going to be called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that the headquarters would be in Chicago, and that the church would be organized into 65 geographic synods around the United States and the Caribbean. And then they set a date of January 1st, 1988, for this new church to begin. During the spring and summer of 1987, the 65 synods that had been organized geographically around the nation met in the spring and summer of 1987 to elect bishops and boards and commissions and so on like that. In other words, to give the new church some structure and to develop budgets and so on like that. I was part of a team of people who were leaders in the area of stewardship, to representatives from the several church bodies to go around and talk in various cities in California and Nevada to explain how it was that stewardship and giving for benevolence was to be done in the new church. And it just began then to hit some people that, hey, this was really going to happen. And there was some reluctance on the part of some people about it being in nervousness, as there is in any new venture. This happened in the spring, in the summer of 1987. In October 1987, happening at the same time, there was a major march on Washington for AIDS and for gay rights. Three seminary students at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, Jeff Johnson, Joel Workin, and Jim Lancaster, had flown to Washington to participate in that march. And they came back, they were seniors at the seminary in Berkeley, and they came back empowered and said that, decided on the plane coming back, that they were going to come out to their faculty, to their fellow students, and to their certification committees. So they met with their candidacy committees. These guys were going to graduate now in June of 88. They met with their candidacy committees in November and December of 87, just a couple months before the new church was to come into operation. These were the candidacy committees of the former American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America. Two of these guys were LCA and one was ALC. And their committees met and they came out to them. And lo and behold, these committees approved them for certification and for call, much to their surprise. So at that point, in early December 1987, nothing happened. Everything was quiet because, after all, Christmas is here, right? And everything gets set aside during the holidays. But very early in January, the first week in January, a news release was sent to a UPI correspondent, David Anderson, that the very first openly gay seminarians had been certified for ordination. And that went out over the wire services and the major newspapers, the New York Times and everywhere else, picked it up, and all hell broke loose. Within about 2 weeks after this happened, and this, remember now, January 1st, 1988, ELCA becomes operative. And the bishops are now meeting in the middle of January. They are, of course, meeting in Florida, which is where a lot of Midwestern organizations meet in the wintertime. And they met there and decided, and the main topic of their discussions was what to do about this. And they said that, you know, we've got this new church body is just starting. We've got all of this furor. My gosh, it's going to get blown out of the water right from the get-go. So we've got to take care of this and take care of it quick. In March 1988, the three bishops in whose territory these three young men resided or were for whom they were responsible, together with the head for the new head of the Division for Ministry, the executive director for the Division for Ministry is Joe Wagner, he still is, met with the three candidates at PLTS, and two of the candidates were informed after these interviews that they would abstain from homosexual relationships, they refused to promise to do that, that they would have their certifications revoked. In the case of Jeff Johnson, Jeff said that he was not in a relationship, and if at some future date he were ever in a relationship, he would inform his bishop. So Jeff, nothing happened to Jeff at that point. In March of 1988, this up here. In March 1988, St. Francis Lutheran Church, which had for at least 10 years, probably longer, been ministering to the gay community, which was right where they were located, held a service called the Liturgy of Our Lives. And they invited all of the churches in the Bay Area to come to this, and the church was full with about 200 people, and people came all over. And this was in support of these three young men for their courage and to stand behind them and to say that we would do what we could to continue to stand behind them. In June 1988, in the face of continued publicity, the Bishop of the Sierra Pacific Synod at the time called in Jeff Johnson and informed him that his certification for call was to be postponed, was the word that he used. This, when we're informed of this, why about 35 pastors, myself included, descended upon the bishop's office and basically said, what in the hell compelled you to do this? We were not satisfied with his answers. And it was clear that he was, to us anyway at the time, that he was being pressured by headquarters in Chicago, and that he felt that this could not continue, this couldn't continue to go on. The Bay Area pastors and laity met then over the next several months, that summer and into the fall, to try to talk about ways that we could challenge this policy of the ELCA, which was now becoming more and more tightly written, and it was being quickly adopted by various of the seminaries, and things were being drafted which we had never had before, documents being drafted which we had never had before in the previous church bodies. But out of these discussions, I'll use Jeff Johnson like this. Anything like it. And out of all those discussions, then came the idea of Lutheran, Lesbian, and Gay Ministries. LLGM, which was to be at that time, as we developed it, in, because of the continuing AIDS crisis and because of all of the young people coming out and people with so many questions, this is almost 10 years ago now, that what had to happen was is that we needed to have in the Lutheran Church, we needed to send a message to gay and lesbian people in the Lutheran Church that there were people standing up for them and willing to come out and say that we are Christians and we are Lutherans and we are loyal to our commitments to God and to Christ, and we are gay and we are lesbian. And to do that, what we would do is that we would call, LLGM would call a openly gay man, presumably who would be Jeff Johnson, who was fully qualified for ministry. And we felt that if we were to have any kind of credibility as a gay, openly gay organization, we also had to call a lesbian. This put an increased financial burden on this new organization, which really didn't have any money. And a lot of the people didn't have any money. But we went ahead anyway. We also recognized that if we were to legally challenge the policies of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America toward gay and lesbian pastors, what we needed to do was not have this separate organization, which had no relationship with the church, call these people, but we had to get congregations to do it. Because in the ELCA structure, only three expressions of the church can issue calls. That's congregations, synods, and the churchwide. Somebody works for an agency of the church, like Lutheran Social Services, why they have to receive a call from the synod that then assigns them. Well, we went through the motions of asking the synod, if LLGM asked the synod, if they would call these people. But of course, we knew that they wouldn't. But we went through the motions of asking that question because we wanted to be responsible church people. The other thing that we did is then to try to find congregations that would call these people. And in April of 1989, LLGM had enough resources that we hired Jeff Johnson as a developer, a mission developer, for I think $500 a month. He used his own computer, and which he was a whiz at. And we got him to start putting together databases of supporters and so on like this to raise money and to put out a newsletter and to gather supporters in meetings. And this Jeff did beginning in April 1989. In October 1989, First United Lutheran Church called Jeff Johnson and St. Francis Lutheran Church in San Francisco also called Ruth Frost and Phyllis Zilhart, who in our nationwide search for lesbian pastors willing to apply for this position that we didn't know would last 3 months or how long. Ruth Frost and Phyllis Zilhart, who were graduates of Luther Seminary in St. Paul, a few years before, put themselves forth as a clergy couple. And the committee, the call committee that was formed with LLGM and the two congregations decided to call them as a couple. Big dates. January 20th and 21st, 1990, there is a service on January 20th, 1990 at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in San Francisco, the church that burned down here a couple of years ago, burned to the ground, a historic 100-year-old church. About 1,000 people there. The national media were there. We were on CNN. We were on CBS Evening News with Connie Chung at that time. It was all over. I mean, it was a big, big deal. On January 20th, they were ordained, the three of them, in this service. The pastors who participated, the Lutheran pastors participated in this laying on of hands in the ordination. There were about 25 or 30 of us. We all did it at the same time. And there were then several pastors from the ecumenical community who participated as well. Finally, the whole congregation did a laying on of hands. It was quite a dramatic thing. The next day, Sunday morning, January 21st, Ruth and Phyllis were installed at St. Francis Lutheran Church. Jeff was installed at First United Lutheran Church. As I was the conference dean, elected by the other churches in San Francisco, I did the installations. On January 22nd, we were served with papers from the Synod and telling us that we were in violation of the ELCA Constitution, and that unless we rescinded the calls and the actions of the day before, we would be subject to discipline.
Who's we?
St. Francis Lutheran Church, the two congregations would. It's the congregations that violated the Constitution. Technically, the technical charge was that we had called people who were not on the approved roster. But the only reason they weren't on the approved roster is because they were gay or lesbian. What happened then was that ultimately we ended up with an ecclesiastical trial, if you will, in July 5th through 7th in 1990. This is not working very well. And how this was set up was, according to the ELCA Constitution, is that discipline committees are made up from a pool of 13 people that are from a pool of about 25 people. And out of those 25 people, the ELCA National Church gets to pick five. I think the way it goes. Yeah, I think they got to pick five, and the Synod got to pick five, and we got to pick, let's see, how did this go? And we were, the two churches were charged. That's right. So First United got to pick two people. St. Francis got to pick two people out of this pool. And so that was four. And then the National Church got to pick four, and the Synod got to pick five or something like that. I forget how it went. Anyway, we ended up with 13 people. And it was a very, very good group of people that came in and listened to our story for 3 days. There were some very, very good people on this committee. They gave us a hearing. And the result was, at the end of that hearing, is that they published a 26-page finding. And the number one thing that they said was is that we had indeed violated, the two churches had indeed violated the ELCA Constitution, and we were to be, therefore, suspended from membership in the ELCA for 5 years. What suspension meant was that our congregations did not have the right to vote at Synod assemblies or to send delegates to the National Convention. But the members of the congregation could serve on Synod boards, council, whatever else is like this, and the pastors could go to the Synod assembly and vote. So it was a real ambiguous kind of suspension.
They want your money, but not your vote.
And they also said, this discipline committee also said, that at the end, that they purposely set it, the suspension at 5 years, because this meant that there were three ELCA national assemblies between the time, between July 1990 and December 31st, 1995. There was the 91 churchwide assembly, the 93 churchwide assembly, and the 95 churchwide assembly. And they said this is no longer enough for the ELCA to quote the findings of predecessor church bodies. They have to look at this issue of homosexuality and about gays and lesbians serving as pastors in the church, of which there have been many, and there are too many people being disappeared and so on like this. So the church has got to deal with this, and we're giving you three national assemblies to vote on this and deal with it. If at the end of this five-year period, St. Francis and First United have not rescinded the calls to these three pastors, or the ELCA has not changed its policies, then St. Francis and First United are to be expelled. However, the vote to suspend us was, I think it was 11 to 1. Yes, 11 to 1, because one person couldn't participate in the panel. Well, the vote to suspend us, I think, was 11 to 1 in favor. The vote to expel us after 5 years was 7 to 5. One vote, and it would not have been that way. Well, as you know, the ELCA could not even come up with a statement on sexuality, let alone on the ordination of gays and lesbians. And here we are, December 31st, 1995. Chris and Phyllis are still serving at St. Francis. Jeff Johnson is now the full-time pastor out at First United because John Frickman had resigned. And not only that, in May 1995, Jeff Johnson was elected dean of the Conference of San Francisco Churches. So we were expelled, and we had on December 31st, 1995, which happened to fall on a Sunday, we had a service which we call the Feast of the Expulsion. We had people come from all over the country, literally, to support us, and we were really very impressed with that. Our bishop was there. He said some very, very good words of support. And both publicly, and they were carefully crafted words, as you can imagine. And once again, why we were on television.
This is a different bishop.
Different bishop. In May 1996, Jeff Johnson was reelected dean of San Francisco Conference. And through this whole period, of our suspension and expulsion, the other churches, with one or two exceptions in San Francisco, have been wholeheartedly supportive. When we have our conference assemblies, St. Francis and First United votes. And if the Synod doesn't accept those votes, why, that's up to them to decide whether they're going to do that. But the other pastors and the other congregations have been very supportive. We have continued to receive mail, both from the National Church and from the Synod. We requested that after our expulsion, we would do that. I should mention also, and this is an important thing that I forgot to mention here, is that in 1993, a resolution was adopted by the Sierra Pacific Synod in its spring assembly to maintain the bond of fellowship with these two suspended congregations even after they are expelled. That was the maintain the bond of fellowship with these two congregations. And that was passed by a fairly healthy margin in our Synod Assembly in 1993. Just to be sure, people felt that it was necessary in 1995, with our expulsion only a few months away, to submit that resolution again and to test the waters. And it was reaffirmed by an even larger margin in the spring of 1995. Further, that resolution by our Synod Assembly was carried to the National Church Convention or Assembly in Minneapolis in August of 1995. That's our last assembly. It's coming up now in 1997. And fortunately, the president of our congregation was able to get on the floor and speak and ask for support for that Synod Assembly, for that resolution from the Sierra Pacific Synod. And in the waning moments of the Synod Assembly, the churchwide assembly, it passed by 79% vote. This gave our bishop in the Pacific Regional Synod some leverage, we thought, in treating our congregations a little differently. And that was reflected when he came for the expulsion service at the end of 1995. Now, where is all this now?
Well, for one thing, the country as a whole is a lot different place than where they were in 1990. Ellen has come out on television. A lot of openly gay characters are parts of sitcoms and soap operas and so on like that. There is a lot of stuff going on throughout the country in the movement and so on like this. And people, one by one, are changing their minds as more and more gay and lesbian people come out. What has happened to our congregation as a result of all of this is, of course, is that it was, as far as evangelism strategy is concerned, it was probably the best thing that we could have done, because what it did was it has brought all kinds of gay and lesbian people back to the church who were alienated from the church, because they say, you know, that's a church I want to check out. So as a result of that, we have received a lot of new members. We've also received financial support from around the country for our actions. We also wanted to find a way to get our story out there. So we produced that cookbook that says Those People at That Church, which is up in the bookstore here. And not only has in it some wonderful recipes, it's not your ordinary cookbook, but it's got pictures on the front of some of our members. Some of Jack and his wife Barb are on the cover, and are a bunch of them. We sold about close to 6,000 of those books, I think of over 6,000 of those books around the country, and it also has the stories in it from people and their witness. First United Lutheran Church, which was a congregation that was down to almost nothing, it's a 100-year-old congregation, it's older than our church, has been gradually building up. And Jeff, now at First United, runs anywhere from 35 to 50 people in church on Sunday, which in San Francisco is not unusual. For any of the churches. We run anywhere from 75 to 100, but we were never down as far as that congregation was. So Pastor Jeff Johnson is doing a very good job. What Lesbian Gay Ministries did in the fall of 1994 was changed from a local Bay Area ministry to gay and lesbian people. And the two churches took over that programmatic aspect and became a national mission society called Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministries, in which we try to support openly gay and lesbian pastors in the Lutheran Church who have, you know, come out. And what was happening is that gay and lesbian pastors around the country were coming out, their congregations were supporting them, but very often, most often what happened is a lot of people in the congregation got mad and left, taking with them maybe a third of the budget. And so LLGM is positioned to support financially those congregations. And it was on the model of the old 19th century mission societies, where immigrants came to this country and they asked for help to get pastors and to get churches from the state churches in Scandinavia and in Germany, and they were turned away, summarily turned away. So the mission societies were organized to train pastors in Europe to send them over here, and that's how the church developed in this country. That's how the Lutheran Church developed in this country, through the mission societies of Europe who supported pastors and congregations here in the missions. That's how some of our fine Lutheran colleges got started too, and seminaries. Okay, I've got the newsletter of LLGM back there. You're welcome to take some copies, the most recent one. We have an executive director now who's an openly gay pastor, and he's in Washington, D.C. He works part-time. And I'm on the board. That's my function. Any questions?
I don't think we lost any members over that year.
No, not at that point. We did not. We did not lose any members of our congregation. I think there was one person who left, but she was leaving anyway. She was leaving town anyway. So,
have your members participated in the conventions? since the action was taken?
Yes. Usually there are some people, we have, usually there are people who are willing to go to the Senate assemblies. But it's really hard to get, as the years have gone by, it's really hard to get them to do that when they can't vote. You know, we sit back at the visitor's table. But up until a year ago, you know, I was able to vote, and one of my associate pastors was able to vote. Now, Ruth and Phyllis and Jeff were never able to vote because they were never rostered. But, yeah.
Well, it seems to me like you would be better off if you've been able to vote.
We've been able to vote?
I mean, you chose your route.
Right.
I think.
Right.
And now you're outside and you have no influence in the voting process. That's difficult.
Yes. The most important thing, though, in church circles is to have voice.
Oh, yes, I agree with that.
Yeah. Is to have voice.
And just so you haven't lost that. Huh?
Yeah. And we haven't had this last Senate assembly. What happened was is that in the beginning of the assembly, they have the adoption of the standing rules. I don't know if you ever noticed this. I mean, most conventions do. You know, they have standing rules. Well, someone got up and asked the standing rules be amended so that St. Francis and First United be given voice but not vote. See, the other thing is that at all of the Synod assemblies, this is a kind of a routine thing. The seminaries, the social service agencies are all have voice but not vote. And so we just asked, what was asked was that we be included in that package of the seminary, social service agencies to be given voice. And that requires a two-thirds majority, and it passed overwhelmingly. So, there's some, what some people have said, I don't agree with you at all, but I admire you for hanging in there. whatever that's worth. Yeah, anything else? Any other questions here?
Do you see that ever getting passed? That you'd be in the foreseeable future that would ever be?
Well, we're independent Lutheran churches now, and that's not new in the Lutheran Church. I mean, there are plenty of old churches out there that have been independent for a long time before they decided to join one of the synods. And I see it happening, but I think it's going to take a lot longer than I had anticipated. I don't think it's going to be any time real soon. Maybe in my lifetime if I live long enough. The reason for that is that I read an article by Garrison Keillor in the New Yorker a few years ago. It was hilarious, called Zeus the Lutheran. And it was talking about this Lutheran pastor who went on a with his wife, the pastor from Pennsylvania, went on a European vacation with his wife, and he was in the Greek Isles, and anyway, and Zeus was floating around, assaulting maidens and doing something like this. And Zeus decided that he was attracted to the minister's wife, and so what he did was that he went into the minister's body and took the minister and put him in the body of a dog. Zeus did. So anyway, so Zeus ends up back in this Lutheran church in Pennsylvania, Zion Lutheran Church in Pennsylvania, in the body of this Lutheran minister, and finally the dog, where the Lutheran minister is with them, and he's in the corner of the study, and the dog, who is the minister, says to Zeus, you could tell these people, you could really tell these people, you could really tell them what needs to be done and how they can be the church. And Zeus answers, of course, this is Garrison Keillor, he says, who are you kidding? He says, you're Lutherans. You never do anything, You just go along. You're Lutheran. You just go along with things. You never do anything. And I thought that unfortunately, is descriptive. And so I think that the only thing that's going to change is when the Supreme Court comes out with a definitive, United States Supreme Court comes out with a definitive statement on gay rights and gay marriage, and allows that, and the Methodists do it, and the Episcopalians do it, and I don't know about the Presbyterians. They've toughened up. And the Lutherans will come up somewhere in the middle or behind, like we always do. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't like your analogy there. As Lutherans may accept what you're presenting, but we are guided by the Bible, yes. And if you contained our interpretation of the Bible, that's what we're studying. Mm-hmm. That's what we're after, and that's going to take a long time.
Yeah, well, of course, Poland Village has been discussing this for 20 years. I mean, if you look at the tapes in there and some of the books that are out there.
That's one thing I like about Poland Village, to come up and listen.
Yeah.
And it's very good.
Right. And it's, and I think it always boils down to what I've found with folks, and it's the same experience that I have had to have had as a straight man. And that is that how many gay people do you know? You know, how many do you know on a personal basis? How many stories have you heard? How many relationships between gay people do you know? How many are you really acquainted with? Are there any gay people in your family? That's always what it boils down to, because whether we were, you know, whether we were talking about slavery in the Lutheran Church, or whether we were talking about women voting, you know, women didn't vote in the ALC until 1960 at Synod Church, in church conventions, district conventions. Women's ordination. The Bible was always brought in to service, of being against those things. And it's the same thing that I think that is happening with the use of the Bible now. And that I find a recent book that is a bestseller that's very, very helpful. It's up here in the bookstore, called The Good Book. And it's really an affirmation of the Bible as a source of faith. And it's written by Peter Gomes, who has been for the last 20 years the pastor at the Memorial Church at Harvard University, an Episcopalian priest. But he's, of course, had to deal with all kinds of students and thoughts and issues. I mean, it doesn't just talk about homosexuality here, but all kinds of things, but mostly about how the Bible is a source of faith and to be used and to acquaint people with what the Bible is and what it is not. Because what he found out with so many students is that they had all these prejudices against the Bible, but they'd never read it. You know. And it's also, he's very, very good, yeah.
I've been to a number of your sessions this week, and I've just found this whole process fascinating. But one thing I haven't heard is your own story.
Oh.
How you got to the point of, you know, I'm just judging from your age, you grew up...
I'm 63.
Yes.
Okay.
But you grew up in an era where homosexuality was not even spoken about, didn't exist. And talking about, maybe share your story on how you came to be in the kind of church that you're in now.
Okay, well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I grew up, not even talking about it. I mean, of course, we did the whole thing about if you wore yellow on Thursday in high school, you were queer or whatever it is, you know, all the characterizations, whatever that meant. Mm-hmm. When I served in my first parish, which is a suburban parish in a bedroom community in Southern California, why there were gay people in there, there were lesbian people. There was a lesbian woman in our church who was involved with a single woman in the church who was a lesbian. I was absolutely oblivious. I didn't have a clue. I mean, I saw them together, you know, all these hours of talking and sitting in the car. I didn't have a clue what was going on. I mean, I look back now, you know, it's really clear. But and there were gay people in the church, and I had a number of gay men come and talk to me who were married and had families and were absolutely distressed about what to do. And I basically said, you know, pray, seek counseling, try to deal with it. This is something that, you know, and I kind of let it go with that. When I, 20 years ago, I was invited to a conference on homosexual, the Church and the Homosexual or something like that, in San Francisco, into which all the bishops of the ALC and the LCA were invited, and all of the, and executives, and all the bishops and executives of the AELC. The only bishop that showed up was a bishop from southern Minnesota by the name of Herb Chilstrom, who ultimately became the first president of the ELCA. I was there along with some other people, and I heard I heard a lot of voices there, but the voices that I heard most of all were the voices of parents of gay and lesbian people. And at the time, I had three teenage children, and I thought to myself, what if this happened to one of my children or their friends? You know, and I began to listen to the parents' story, and one story that particularly impressed me was a woman who was an elderly woman who had moved out to San Francisco from a little town in Pennsylvania to be with her one and only son. She was a widow, who was gay. And this was a woman who had been president of the LCW, president, you know, taught Sunday school for 30 years. I mean, this was one of these women that we as pastors value in our church as a saint. And she told how she didn't understand or know about her son until she asked him, and he was 38 years old. And she said finally, "Don, are you gay?" And he said, "Yes," because there was always this, they were close, but there was always this something between them. And then she said, he started talking to me, and as he was talking to me and opening up about himself and so on, and all I could think of was all those wasted years. And, you know, all those wasted years between a mother and a son. And I've heard stories like that again and again so many times, and how many men, particularly in my generation, who never told their parents, who would go back to Iowa or Wisconsin or wherever and have to go back in the closet. And one guy in our church who's was with the same partner for 26, 27 years. You know, every time he was an only child, had a wonderful relationship with his parents, but it got to the point where they were aged and didn't have all of their faculty. They were in their 90s, and he couldn't tell them anymore. That was the thing. And then I listened to all the stories. When I came to St. Francis to be interviewed by the call committee, they asked me, how do you feel about ministering to and with gay and lesbian people? This is in 1981, 4 years after, or 3 or 4 years after this. And by that time, I had done a lot of reading and a lot of wake-up calls. And I saw it as the same thing that I went through and what we went through in the 1960s with the civil rights movement, blacks in this country, same thing as the women's movement. Now it was just a different group of people that were being cut out, not because of anything they did, but because of who they were. And the other thing is that it wasn't criminal to be a woman in this country, but it sure as heck is still a crime in some places to be a gay person. In the church, which ought to be protecting people and inviting people in, driving their own children. These weren't people who we didn't know. These were our own children who were driving out. Because the people who came to our parish to join it were graduates of St. Olaf and from Augsburg and Gustavus and all of the great Lutheran schools. Some of them had thoughts about going into ministry. And we've been great pastors in the church. Jeff Johnson is an absolutely outstanding pastor.
Yeah. Sure is.
Outstanding pastor. Phyllis Zilhart has had the heart of a pastor. She said she wanted to be a pastor when she was 6 years old, never thought about being anything else. An absolutely wonderful pastor.
Ruth Frost's history, her family history?
Yeah, Ruth Frost is the daughter of Gerhard Frost, who is a much-loved professor at Luther Seminary for over 30 years. His book is in there. He's deceased. His book is Seasons of, what is it called, Seasons of a Life? Or is in the bookstore here, a book of poems and devotions. Gerhard Frost. I never met him, but... anybody here have Gerhard Frost, professor? So that's kind of my story. Tell you, I mean, I've learned an awful lot since I've been serving this parish time. So we kind of all, you know, I learned from them.
Are your staff people? The other pastors, are they
engaged
or what?
Yes, we have two full-time pastors, myself and Phyllis Zilhart, who's full-time, and then her partner Ruth Frost is part-time, and Michael Hiller, who has been on our staff as an assistant pastor, who's non-stipended for many years. But he is now stipended. He's been with us for 14 years, and he's an openly gay man in a partnership. And he's still on the roster of the ELC. He's never been off. He got a call. When we called him in 1983 or 4 as a non-stipendiary pastor, it was Bishop Nelson Trout, who was our bishop at that time in ELC, who pushed that. And Dr. Trout knew he was gay. Remember Bishop Trout? He was the only African American pastor we had, or bishop we had for a while in the beginning. He was the first one, actually.
He came up here a couple of times.
Yeah, and I think he was up here at Holden, wasn't he? A powerful preacher.
So what does the church do once they've ordained a man or a woman, and then they come out? Is there an automatic expulsion process similar to the automatic exclusion that happens if they come out before they're ordained?
Well, there's a mixed bag of things that are happening. Just a couple of stories. Brad Schmeling, who was the pastor of Trinity Lutheran? No, Trinity Lutheran Church. Why can't I remember the name of the Lutheran Church? Anyways, the Lutheran Church in Columbus, Ohio. He came out to his congregation. The congregation supported him. The bishop asked him to resign. He refused. And Brad refused. But Brad was not in a relationship, so what was the bishop going to charge him with? Because the guidelines, in this case, now that these guidelines are here, supporting because he wasn't in a relationship. It says if you are in a, basically says if you're in a relationship or you're sexually active, you can. So Brad, the congregation supported him. Some of the folks left, and LLGM came in with money to support them to get them through the time for about a couple of years. And as a result, a lot of gay people come on. This is out on one end of Columbus, as I understand. It's not, you know, so people have to travel some distance to get there. And it's a suburban blue-collar congregation. But, these folks were 100% behind them. They learned a lot. And I will say this about Brad Schmeling, who's now in graduate school at Emory University. He did a marvelous job. He went around to every family in that congregation, individually came out to them so that they could deal with them one-on-one. That takes guts.
Wow.
And,
totally. Yeah.
You know, and Brad says the people who supported him from the very beginning, you know, were most supportive, were the elderly people. People in their 80s. know, that was true at St. Francis when I came. The people who were the most welcoming of anybody who came in the door were these elderly people in their late 70s and 80s. Yeah, those were the folks. Recently, Steve Saban in a town in Iowa, this escapes me.
Ames, Iowa.
Ames, Iowa has come out. Well, first he came out to the bishop. The bishop asked, and he's in a relationship, the bishop asked him for his resignation. And he refused and went back to his congregation. The bishop came and spoke to the congregation, said, these are the rules which you have to do. And the congregation says, no way. And they supported their pastor. And that was not that long ago. And that's what that article is about that you see here, with the copies of the letters that went back and forth. And Steve is holding his ground, and so is the congregation. And so we'll see what happens. But I tell you, when gay pastors come out, we tell them, unless you've got your congregation behind you, you know, you better, because you have to remember that the structure of the church, the bishops and all of that, they have their rules. And even though that they're your good friends and everything else, they become your adversaries. And we have a kind of a funny thing in the Lutheran Church in this country. We've always had congregational polity. That is, that the major power and the money is in the congregations, and the pastors, I think, we have this kind of healthy thing where the bishop and so on recommends pastors candidates to congregations, but congregations make the decisions. Congregations make the decision what to pay their pastors. Congregations make the decision what to send in to support the larger church. So there's this kind of, I think, healthy tension that we have in our system that I think that we have a record, I think, in the Lutheran Church of pastors and congregations having some pretty healthy and successful relationships. Now, I say that from the perspective of looking 35 years back. I mean, sure, we got some bad apples, but I don't think we have the trouble that some of the where pastors are primarily employed by the bishop, like you do in the Episcopal Church and the Methodist Church, where they get moved around, you know, time they want to. But I think we have a good system. But, huh?
Well, is this issue coming up at all with the Missouri Synod?
Well, the Missouri Synod did not even ordain women. They have come out against the ordination of women. They've also come out very much, very, they're adamant about this. They dismissed a professor in one of their schools in Southern California who had been with them for, had been a Lutheran school teacher, which is almost as good as a pastor. I mean, they have some kind of same status as a pastor, a called teacher and professional musician in the Missouri Synod. And they dismissed him simply for singing in the Los Angeles Gay Men's Chorus. I mean, he had done nothing other than that, and he was just dismissed. So it's pretty hard and pretty harsh. Just about the time that we think we've gotten over things, and sometimes in San Francisco we take things so much for granted. Yeah. And we have marriages, and we have the mayor conducting, you know, mass weddings of lesbian and gay people, and we get out of the Bay Area, and it's stuff that we heard 20 years ago, huh?
Pretty supportive in all the Bay Area or just San Francisco itself?
No, it's more and more throughout the Bay Area. It really is. Of course, San Francisco takes the lead, but you know, San Francisco's record of the way it's treated gay and lesbian people is not very salutary. I mean, within the time that I've lived in my neighborhood, I live just above the Castro. My wife and I just live above the Castro, and not that long ago, it seems. What is it, when they raided the Elephant Walk, the major gay bar, the police raided it? It's not that long ago. And to hear some of the older guys. We got a retired merchant marine cook Carl DeBell belongs to our church. Carl's, oh, he's supposed to be my age, maybe closer to your age, yeah. He talks about the way it was in the 1950s. There were gay bars, he says, but there were always police informants, and he says, and you could be in the bar, but you couldn't touch. Mm-hmm. You could talk, but you couldn't touch. I mean, there was all these, and if you touched, you were arrested. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of
stuff. One of the things that kind of won me over to this cause was an incident that happened in Los Angeles. It was in the 60s, and I was going to a movie, and at the time I smoked, and I needed to get a pack of cigarettes, and I went across the street to a bar to get a pack of cigarettes out of a vending machine. And I was in there about 5 minutes, and the place was raided. Mm-hmm. And I mean raided, I mean serious, you know, bodily injury, brutality beyond anything I ever imagined. And I was swept in with the whole bunch, put into jail. It was just, I couldn't believe anything like that could happen in our country. And of course, I was eventually released and everything, but boy, it was awful being there. That's why people tell me that being gay is a choice. I don't know anyone that would choose that kind of a life.
Why do they plot in front of it? That's something that's an affront.
Some do.
Some do, yes.
Some do.
And
there is as much an affront to us as they are to you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm...
But they do that too.
Pardon?
Some heterosexuals.
Yes, they do that too.
But that's the basic thing. If you believe it's a choice, well, then of course none of this makes any sense to you. But once you realize that people don't choose to be this way anymore, than they choose to be right-handed or left-handed or have black, blue eyes or brown eyes, or black skin or white skin, or male or female. You know, and the whole notion of us all being one in Christ, I think, is something we need to pay attention to. Well, anything else? I'm glad to stick around if you want to ask me individually, but I think we ought to stop for the sake of those folks who want to go and get ready for dinner. Thank you very much.
Thank you.